You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates two new subvariants of Omicron are making up more than 70% of COVID-19 cases in the United States. Omicron BA4 and BA5 were first detected in the U.S. a couple of months after being detected in South Africa. With the rise in BA4 and BA5 cases, specialists are bringing up the possibility of an Omicron-targeted booster vaccine that could be ready for adults maybe as soon as this fall. Dr. Daniel Shirley is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. Dr. Shirley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What, if any, are the differences in symptoms between BA4 and 5 and all the other variants we've had so far?
Well, there's really no expectation that the symptoms of this is going to be any different than the previous subvariants. Like we've talked about before, all of these subvariants are still Omicron, mm-hmm. and the symptoms are expected to be similar.
How do they compare when it comes to how contagious they are?
That's really the issue here and what people are concerned about. You know, we've done these kind of switches in the proportions of subvariants before, but each time we talk about the concern that it might be more transmissible, and that's sort of a natural way of viruses. Obviously, for it to overtake the other ones, it needs to be spread more successfully. So that really is the concern with these, especially BA5. It seems to be taking over and really seems to be more transmissible.
All right, that's contagion. Now, how about virulence, I think you call it in the industry? How dangerous these variants are? Do we have enough information to make a call on that so far?
We don't. This is a little bit like before, too, in that we really need to see what happens in real life. I think in the lab, there's a little bit of concern that it seems to have a predilection for the lungs again. But in places where this subvariant has already been seen, they haven't noticed any big differences in the type of disease that it causes. Obviously, this is very complicated because people have different exposures to prior infection or vaccination, including multiple vaccinations. So, it's a little hard to compare one person to another. It really depends on your previous kind of antibody levels.
Now, it's more contagious, these two new variants of Omicron are new-ish now. Does that mean they're better at overcoming vaccines or immunity from past exposure to some other kind of COVID?
Right. I think that what we're seeing with these new subvariants is that it escapes the immunity more readily. That means that even if you have antibodies from prior infection or vaccination, even if that was fairly recent, this subvariant seems to sort of disguise itself and those antibodies don't work as well. So that's one of the things that makes it spread more readily and really is the concern here that, like we've seen before, it's a combination. Even if it doesn't cause more severe disease, if it causes disease in lots of people, it still causes a big problem and it can include increases in hospitalization.
That said, comparing someone who's completely unvaccinated and unexposed to somebody who's vaccinated or exposed to past COVID, you're still better off, right, with those antibodies?
Yeah, so what we're talking about is that it spreads more readily. But so far, we haven't seen a huge uptick in hospitalizations. So however you've created those antibodies, and the safest way to do that is to get a vaccination, that does seem to still have some protection against getting severe disease. So that's really the message right now that, if you're eligible for this extra booster and you haven't gotten it yet, I think now is kind of the time to think about it with your doctor as we go into, an increase in this subvariant.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Shirley, infectious disease specialist at UW Health, looking at the newest Omicron variants that seem to be in wide circulation here in the United States and in a lot of the world, too. There's been talk about more targeted vaccine boosters, kind of, I guess, updated and finagled to account for the Omicron variant. What are you watching for there?
That's a little bit why I say if you're eligible for a booster now, I think it's worth thinking about because there's a little bit of sort of discussion about how to make the next booster, whether that should be Omicron BA2, so specific to Omicron, but not necessarily specific to BA4 or 5, or should we wait and create a vaccine that's potentially targeted even more at the latest subvariant? So, which kind of booster is rolled out may matter. And obviously, we can see how fast these subvariants can rise and take over. So you wouldn't want to create, put all your eggs in a basket, let's say.
Now, we've seen, it's hard, we haven't had enough years to maybe make predictions based on past years. There's concern, I know, that the fall in Wisconsin is a time when we could see numbers go back up. What are you watching for? Maybe what are you worried about as we head toward the fall?
So like many other respiratory viruses, the fall and winter is the time where those cases rise. And that has to do with, you know, the temperature, people going inside, being in groups closer together, that type of stuff. So, you know, I think we're just have a general concern about that. That in past, we've noticed increased cases of COVID in those time periods. Now, you know, with these kind of new variants and subvariants, I think it's even more concerning so that we get the timing right, so that, you know, we have all the tools we need. The other big part of this, of course, is even outside of vaccines and other things, of just the general protections and when people should use those. You know, those things like spacing out, wearing masks when you're in crowded spaces, especially indoors, and, you know, improving our ventilation in general. You know, that's easy in the summer when we're outside, but how do we do that as we go into the fall and winter?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the masking in particular. What are you telling people these days who ask when and where do I need to wear a mask?
Well, I think the first discussion is, you know, are you indoors or outdoors? I think outdoors generally pretty safe as long as you can kind of space out to a degree. Once you're indoors, it's a little bit about how close are you going to be to other people and what's the ventilation in that location. And if you don't know what that's going to be like, I think the default would be to take a mask and wear it. You know, if you're really going to be in a close proximity to people for a long period of time, that's when you think about increasing your mask level. That is, use an N95 or a KN95, something like that.
Dr. Shirley, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Daniel Shirley, infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He joined us today to talk about the latest COVID-19 subvariants, BA4 and BA5, the possibility of Omicron-targeted vaccines that could be available as early as this fall. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition surrounding fish.
People have been fishing the Mississippi River for about 1,000 years. It's a tradition that's passed down through families for survival and recreation. Mike Valley is part of that tradition and one of the last people to still make a living as a commercial fisherman on the Upper Mississippi. And when he gets his catch, he often smokes it. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy hopped on Valley's boat to learn more about his smoked fish and his love of the river.
There are few fishermen like Mike Valley left on the Mississippi River.
The millions of pounds of fish that I've caught, it's still peace and tranquility for me out here. It is a lost art, it's a dying art. Like sitting here right now, I mean, this is just absolutely beautiful to me. To get out of that phone ringing, people knocking all day, every day, it's just like, ah.
Valley is a third generation fisherman. The work is in his blood. He's owned Valley Fish and Cheese in Prairie du Chien since the 1980s. He grew up hunting, trapping, clamming, and working with his father. His dad also had a shop on the river and sold his fish to markets in Chicago, New York, and Boston. But as the fishing industry changed, Valley knew the only way he was going to survive was by forging his own path. Sell quality, fresh fish and products that you can't find anywhere else.
I've always said, you'll never have anyone come into my shop and then leave and then go home and tell all their friends and their relatives, this guy had beef jerky. Or, oh my God, he had Colby cheese. No, he had snapping turtle jerky, he had alligator jerky, catfish bologna, the weird things.
Valley is particular. Years of fishing and smoking his catch have taught him that you can't cut corners if you want to stand out. Even though he's caught millions of pounds of fish, the novelty hasn't worn off.
I still really, truly enjoy catching fish. The cleaning, not so much. But that's part of the job. Everybody that I take with me always, they're like, oh my God, this is so fun. This is really great. And then you get back and they go, see ya.
So. Valley cleans the fish, typically catfish, carp, buffalo, and sturgeon, up to 4 times. Then he brines it for at least half a day. Details matter. Not all fish are the same, and they shouldn't be treated the same, he says. The thicker the fish, the more salt you're going to need. And each fish gets its own brine with different seasonings that bring out its flavors. Venvalley puts the fish in the smoker, which he claims is the only licensed 100% wood smoker left in the state.
We light it with wood, it ends with wood. No liquid smoke, no gas, no nothing. And that is huge. It makes a world of difference. Basically, we're all hickory. Well, once in a while, we'll burn a little apple wood.
And it can't be rushed. Patience is key. Valley could finish the fish in an hour, but he prefers to give it 10 to 12 hours to really soak up the smoky flavor.
I relate it to a sponge. If you just barely hold it on the water, just missed it, it sucks it in and it takes time. So that's what you want to do with the fish. You want to very slowly permeate it and bring it up to temp. You know, otherwise if you just cook it, it's just a cooked piece of fish. Yeah. It isn't smoked.
1734.
Valley jokes about a law he has at Valley Fish and Cheese when customers make a modest purchase. Once you buy it and leave the door, you can't come back in and buy more.
I will literally, honestly, hear 10 times a day, this is unbelievable smoked fish. Well, it is. Because it was swimming yesterday and it's smoked today. It's to die for.
Yet all that being said, Valley says you don't necessarily need to head over to the Mississippi and catch the fish yourself. He recommends finding a nice piece of salmon or fish of your choice and practicing a little patience.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Mike Valley's smoked fish. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, sexually transmitted infection rates have been going up, even during the pandemic. We'll find out how to keep yourself and others safe and healthy. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The CDC says sexually transmitted infection, or STI, cases continued to climb in the first year of the pandemic as COVID-19's strain on the healthcare system affected testing and prevention efforts. The latest numbers for 2020 show congenital syphilis at its highest rate in 26 years, and people aged 15 to 24 contracted about half of 2020's reported infections. Megan Meller is an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Those were the national CDC numbers I just mentioned. What are we seeing here in Wisconsin?
We're seeing the exact same thing in Wisconsin. So last Friday, the state of Wisconsin released their data. And honestly, it reflects everything that the CDC reported. So we're seeing the exact same trends at the state level and also at the local level here in La Crosse County.
This had been going on before the pandemic, right? This has been a trend and the pandemic didn't stop it. What have you seen in the long term?
I think in the long term, it's really just more and more cases. So, you know, every year we kind of expect, even internally, when we start seeing more STI cases, you know, spring break, start of school, and, you know, here locally, Oktoberfest. But what we're seeing now is it's more and more cases. It's more among that 15 to 24 year old population. We're also seeing more cases coming up among, I would say, the 45, 50 plus age group too, which before, you know, that was rare. So overall, it's just increasing.
You have a message to share, I think, about access and availability to testing and prevention. What do you want people to know?
So testing is really important, and I really can't underscore that enough. You know, we see oftentimes what we see, especially among men, is they only get tested once they've been exposed or if they have symptoms. And what we really recommend for everyone is at the start of a new relationship, go ahead and get tested. It's so easy, and there's really affordable ways to get tested, whether it's through a primary care provider, Planned Parenthood, University Health is another really big avenue. But we often see, especially among men, is that they present to urgent care or the emergency department, which, you know, they will test, but that's often associated with a pretty significant cost too, when there's all these other really easy ways to go and get tested. And so we've worked really closely with the health department to explore how to get that education out there, that there's these other easy ways to get tested.
Prevention and testing are important. How many of the most common sexually transmitted infections are treatable?
All of them are treatable, and that's the really great thing. You know, I think what people don't know is that you can also be infected with these STIs and be asymptomatic, so not even realize. So one of the things we find is that's coming out in the data is that women are testing positive at a higher rate for especially like chlamydia and gonorrhea compared to men. And that's just because women are getting tested more regularly. You know, they're going in for their primary care appointments, and there's federal guidelines recommending that women do get tested frequently. So even if they're asymptomatic, they're catching it. When they're going in for prenatal appointments, we're catching it. But for men, we don't have those same guidelines. And so really the best, you know, best prevention is getting tested right away so you can get treated, because these are really treatable infections. You know, the antibiotics are, you know, they work really well. And you mentioned congenital infections too. So those are the infections passed from mom to baby. Those are really treatable, especially in those early stages of pregnancy when it hasn't yet, you know, transmitted to the baby. And so really testing and then getting treated right early on is critical.
Talking to Megan Meller, infection preventionist with Gunderson Health in La Crosse, looking at a steady rise in sexually transmitted infections in the United States. And as you heard earlier, that's true here in Wisconsin as well. Now, you mentioned earlier, 15 to 24-year-olds have a lot of the cases of these STIs. What kind of outreach do you see as being important to spread the message to help prevent these diseases?
One of the really great things about being in the healthcare system right now is there's a really great collaborative I'm a part of with La Crosse County that's also partnered with Planned Parenthood and Student Health. And we're really pulling on college students to help us do that outreach. So to do the research, to understand what are the behaviors and attitudes that are driving, you know, this increase in STIs, and then what are successful ways to address it, you know, because they're the ones that are, you know, in that culture already. So they have a really good understanding, you know, to start asking those questions and then to help us develop effective ways to address it. So those are some of the avenues that we're looking forward to in the next year is expanding upon and really utilizing those, that age group.
Now, when I was in that age group, I'll age myself here, the AIDS epidemic was all over the news and the headlines. And I think it got people talking and being willing to be very frank about safe sex and sexually transmitted illnesses. Do you see a reluctance to talk about that? Is this something that's on people's radar?
You know, you touched right on it. We definitely do see a reluctance. And and part of it too is I think this misconception with birth control. And so birth control is so widely available, you know, and it's a wonderful thing, but most birth controls don't provide protection against STIs. Only the barrier methods do, like condoms. And what we're finding is that condom use really is declining among this population. They, you know, they're relying more on that birth control. And so part of the education that we're trying to get out is that it's really important to use those barrier methods as a form of protection against these STIs.
Now, do you have thoughts on how parents can have that conversation with their kid as they approach that age group?
I think having this very open and honest conversation about it and not, you know, shaming it, you know, it's a part of, you know, health is getting tested. Another thing that's really important to note too, I think children over the age, the health department over the age of 12 can get tested without parental consent. So if they go into their doctor, they can get tested and their parents don't, you know, need to know about it. But I think it's even better for parents to kind of have that honest conversation with their child and make sure that if their child is sexually active, that they're using, you know, they're using contraceptives and also getting tested regularly.
And for especially people in that younger age group that's most at risk, for people who are sexually active, what's the recommendation how often they should get tested?
We recommend getting tested, you know, anytime you have symptoms, you know, that, you know, you find questionable, if you want to go get, that's a good, you know, easy way first to get tested. We also recommend at the start of any new sexual relationship is to go, and in fact, both partners can go and get tested before you become sexually active. That's a really easy way to, again, to make sure that you're not, you know, you're not spreading these infections further, because so many of them do present asymptomatic, especially among men. And so again, making sure that even if you don't have any symptoms, you're just going ahead and seeking that testing and getting that answer done.
I've mostly been asking about individual testing and treatment. Are there community level efforts that seem to be especially effective?
In terms of, you know, community efforts that we're finding effective, it's just some public health outreach. You know, using social media has been effective. in other public health departments across the country. So utilizing Twitter, putting ads out on dating apps too, has been relatively effective. But again, I think some of it, you have to go at it from multiple ways to start seeing more acceptance of testing, barrier methods, and treatment.
And just our last minute, Megan, maybe a dumb question here. We used to say STDs a lot more, sexually transmitted diseases. Now it seems like STI, sexually transmitted infections, is what people do. Same thing, or is there an important distinction there?
You know, I think it is the same thing, but when I think of infections, I think of those who are also asymptomatic. Mm. And so with diseases, you're actually having symptoms. And so this, using this new terminology, highlights the fact that you might not even have symptoms, but you'll still be able to transmit it to a partner.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Megan Miller, infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Megan was with us today to talk about what she's seeing in terms of sexually transmitted infection rates and what people can do to stay healthy as the CDC reports those numbers going up around the country. Same is true here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, what gives meaning to life? The answer to that question may have changed lately for many Americans. A philosopher joins the show for a look at the search for meaning, and you can share your answer to that question. We'll look at a case that the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear later this year that could have a big impact on how states manage presidential and other federal elections. And how do non-human animals see the world and hear and smell and feel the world? Check out The Sensory World of Animals. We'll talk to the author of An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. You can let us know if your dog or cat seem to perceive things that you cannot. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to an environmental law professor about last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that limits the EPA's ability to regulate power plant emissions related to climate change. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden and others are calling on Congress to bring back a federal ban on assault weapons after recent mass shootings in Buffalo, Uvalde, and now Highland Park, Illinois. We'll look into whether the 1994 assault weapons ban helped curb violence and what type of gun reforms could make a difference. First, the U.S. Supreme Court last week ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't have broad authority to set limits on carbon emissions from power plants. The EPA had been operating under the Clean Air Act from 1970. The court's decision said that law does not extend to include this type of regulation. The ruling could set a legal precedent to challenge other climate change regulations in the future. The EPA says it'll continue trying every legal authority it has to reduce pollution and fight climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this U.S. Supreme Court ruling? What is your reaction to it? How much authority do you think the EPA should have to regulate climate change-related emissions from power plants? Do you want Congress to weigh in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Steph Tai is a law professor at UW-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us a little more about what this U.S. Supreme Court decision means about what the EPA can't do?
Well, it's although some reporting has said that the Supreme Court made a decision that the EPA can't regulate greenhouse gases, it's actually more limited than that. What it focuses on is this new source performance standards program under the Clean Air Act, which allows the regulation of certain pollutants from existing stationary sources, such as power plants. What the EPA tried to do under the Obama administration was use this sort of best system of emissions reduction, and then determine that the best system of emissions reduction was to move towards other types of fuels. So they had these provisions in the Clean Power Plan to move to, say, generation shifting improvements to natural gas plants and generation shifting improvements to wind and solar energy. That was struck down by the Supreme Court, saying that if there's such a huge thing, this is the major questions doctrine that the Supreme Court brought up, if it's such a large change, then it has to be something that's clearly stated by Congress. And so this generation shifting approach that the Obama EPA tried to use and might have been used by the Biden administration, now that's off the table. There are still other things they can do. The Massachusetts versus EPA decision, which was in 2006, still stands, which means that the EPA can still regulate greenhouse gases coming from motor vehicles, other transportation sources. The Biden administration can still work on infrastructure types of reductions. They can require potentially things like carbon capture, but it does take some of the sort of generation shifting provisions off the table.
Now, how about can the EPA go to an existing coal power plant and say, hey, we're going to make you tighten up on emissions. We're going to make you control and limit the flow of emissions from this particular plant. Is that covered in this ruling? Is that beside the point on this ruling?
Well, what this ruling basically says is it can't do this directly through regulation of greenhouse gases, but there's a lot of other emissions that come from power plants. For example, particulate matter, which leads to asthma and a lot of other nasty health effects, this thing still be regulated. And so the more stringent those other types of regulations are, the more efficient these power plants will work and thus actually end up reducing carbon emissions along with those other types of pollutant reductions.
Is it the case that under the Clean Air Act, when it was originally passed, it covered things like those particulate emissions you just mentioned, but nobody was really that worried about climate change emissions when that law was passed?
Well, the dissent actually addressed that. So the majority says that no one was really concerned about this, but the dissent points to how Congress deliberately chose a more discretionary term, best system of emissions reduction, to take into account that potentially Congress didn't have an idea of what specific types of things needed to be regulated and thus accorded the EPA a lot of latitude in deciding how to set emissions limits.
We're talking to Steph Tighe from UW-Madison, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the EPA and climate change regulations. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. What kind of powers do you want the Environmental Protection Agency to have when it comes to regulating climate change emissions? Where do you draw the line and say that's too much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steph, I know some people in the environmental community are worried that this is a first step, that the precedent set by the U.S. Supreme Court could open the door to other challenges to climate change-related regulation from the federal government. Is that something you see as being likely?
It can be a concern. A lot of discussion has occurred around the major questions doctrine, which I mentioned before. The court applied this doctrine to say, look, in areas where it's such a major deal if the EPA regulates or any agency regulates, then the court has to expect that Congress said something about that matter within the sort of language of the Clean Air Act or whatever act it is. This is a doctrine that has some history. It was applied in this case called Brown versus Williamson, where the FDA tried to regulate nicotine and the Supreme Court said no. Even though it's technically a drug, it's such a big deal that Congress would have said so in the authorizing statute for the Food and Drug Administration that we see that the agency overstepped its authority. This might be a concern with climate change in the sense that if you apply the major questions doctrine, it's basically saying, okay, in areas where it's too big a deal, we're not going to accord the agency any discretion in terms of interpreting even fairly clear language from their authorizing statute. And so that can be a big deal in terms of cordoning off what agencies can do to address things that Congress did not specifically contemplate.
Well, you mentioned transportation as part of the climate change emissions picture here. Could somebody take this major questions doctrine and say, hey, our fuel economy standards, to the extent that they're meant to help address climate change, they're not authorized under existing laws either?
Well, they might, except that the Supreme Court already spoke to that in Massachusetts versus EPA, which was about carbon emissions coming from motor vehicles. So, yes, someone could raise that challenge, but they would have to argue that Massachusetts versus EPA needs to be overturned. Now, we've seen from this term's court that the court may very well overturn prior precedent. They've already shown their willingness to do so, but hopefully this will still be in more limited circumstances.
Now, as you mentioned, this is just one part of EPA regulation of climate change. But I've seen even the Biden administration saying, yeah, this ties our hands some. How big, I don't know if you want to put number percentages on it or anything, how big a deal is this in terms of the ability to, you know, try to meet international agreements, for example, on emissions?
I think it does tie their hands a lot. So power plants are one of the major sources of carbon emissions. And to the extent that this stops the EPA from trying to force the shift away from coal-fired power plants into natural gas, which is still carbon emitting, but is more efficient in burning. So you get less carbon per sort of electricity generated, and also to wind and solar, it's going to be a big hurdle. Like I said, there's still other areas where the federal authority can do things, but right now it's going to be really within the realm of the states to do things. California has a strong carbon plan, so does New York. They're trying to work on moving sort of transportation mixes, power generation mixes into areas other than coal-fired plants. We'll see what happens there. And the other thing to recognize too is that coal-fired plants, in a way, the Supreme Court decision is almost propping up a technology that is getting more and more obsolete. For example, in Wisconsin, we had a large percentage in the 1990s of power generation coming from coal-fired plants. It's moved away from that to like a minority of stuff coming from coal-fired plants and more into natural gas and renewables. So in a way, the technology is still moving away, but perhaps slower than the sort of Biden administration might want.
We're talking about climate change regulations after last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the EPA and its ability to regulate climate change emissions in the energy industry. UW-Madison Law Professor Steph Tai is with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the EPA and climate change emission regulations? What questions do you have about this ruling and what it means? Do you want to see more pressure from the federal government to move away from fuels, especially coal? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison Law Professor Steph Tai, looking at the impact of last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that limits the EPA's ability to limit carbon emissions from power plants. It may set a precedent for other kinds of regulation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about that ruling? What questions do you have about the EPA's authority? Are you concerned about other climate change regulations being challenged? What would you like to see Congress and/or President Biden do in response? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to our callers now. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I look at this decision and I definitely see it as a step in the wrong direction. I'm also concerned if there's something of a corruption aspect, because a lot of businesses promoted the particular Supreme Court members getting through that signed off on this decision. Koch Industries was one in particular, and they are involved in the coal business. And more locally, I believe it was Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, when they were on WPR's morning show, promoted using coal and claimed that not doing so would be short-sighted, except if you look at coal itself, it's very polluting. Economically, it was losing out to natural gas anyway. But these are people who I think are protecting the ability to pollute in spite of all the damages it causes other people, including both property and lives lost. And there is nothing, I think, more dishonest or short-sighted than ignoring that. And maybe a response Biden could do is remove the federal ban on lawsuits over global warming damages.
Nate, thanks for the call. Let's pick up on that last point. Steph, I don't know. I guess I'm not familiar with that, a ban on lawsuits related to climate change, but the idea of lawsuits related to climate change damage, is that a thing that's going on?
Well, there have been lawsuits related to climate change damage. And that actually, what's really interesting about this is that a lot of these lawsuits, courts treated them as preempted, because there is a system of federal regulation about this. Preemption is a doctrine that says that if there's enough federal regulation about something, you can't bring these sort of state-based lawsuits against stuff. What's interesting about this case is that the Supreme Court has now said that the EPA can't regulate through this generation-forcing kind of manner power plants. And so that actually might have the ironic effect of reopening up some of these state-based lawsuits that have been going on, in the sense that the Supreme Court has said, you know, there's no federal occupation of this field here, and therefore maybe this opens it up for states. We'll see what happens.
Nate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lou joins us next in Cudahy. Lou, hello.
Hello. Angela Merkel's Germany, she's no longer the chancellor there, made the mistake, the huge mistake, of shutting down all their nuclear power plants. And just today or yesterday, the economic union members have asked Germany to not shut down all their coal plants and get away from coal, because they're going to be restricted from Putin getting Russian gas and natural gas and oil and fuel. So they put themselves in the particular position of being strangled by Putin, and now there are going to be shortages in Germany. This is the kind of fear-mongering that exists in the climate change community, and it's used to shut down commerce and industry, and now you're going to watch the German people suffer. Oh, by the way, when they got rid of the nuclear power plants, their energy prices went up 30%.
Lou, thanks for the call. Now, nuclear is in a unique position, I think, in climate change, energy sources stuff. But do you have thoughts on what Lou had to say?
Really just so nuclear is an interesting question. I actually am pretty agnostic about nuclear. I'm not opposed to it. I am interested in it as a way of adapting to climate change. But with respect to coal has already been a type of technology that we've been moving away from. Natural gas has been taking over. The economics are in favor of natural gas. So I would say that, you know, to the extent that we're artificially propping up anything, it's probably coal. But that said, I understand the geopolitical conflicts that are involved. And yes, we do have a sort of fuel-reliant kind of grid. And so what everyone's sort of tackling is how to move it in a way that is going to be sustainable in the long run.
Talking to Steph Tighe, law professor at UW-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week, one of many big rulings. It gives some limits on the EPA's ability to regulate climate change emissions from the energy sector, from power plants in particular. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know what, if anything, you'd like to see Congress or the White House do when it comes to climate change. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Steph, let's look at those other two branches of government now. I think the majority in the Supreme Court opinion suggested if Congress specifically wants the Clean Air Act to allow the EPA to do this, well, they can vote on that and do that. Do you think there are prospects for Congress to update the Clean Air Act along those lines?
To the extent that this is a call for Congress, it can be something that some Congress members can use to lobby each other, because they've been given this, you know, direct charge from the Supreme Court to do something about it. To the extent that anything will actually happen, I don't actually know. There's a lot of complicated dynamics with a number of, with both respect to bipartisan collaboration, which has been shown to be pretty low in recent years, and also with some members having sort of direct concerns with their own state economies. And so that's all going to be in the mix. I don't know what will happen with Congress.
We got an email from Sam who says they'd love to see Congress make any move to fight climate change. But since Congress is currently broken, Sam says, we need the executive branch to wield all its power to make up for decades of inaction. And I know the EPA is reviewing its authority, trying to figure out what to do that isn't blocked by the U.S. Supreme Court when it comes to power plants. What kind of options do you see there from the executive branch?
The other options I mentioned earlier were also, so EPA can still regulate things like motor vehicles. They can also regulate other pollutants, which in turn can have carbon emissions reductions. They could potentially, and though this will be probably be challenged in court, try to require carbon capture and storage technologies for power plants, which they could call their best system of emissions reductions. Although again, like I said, that's probably going to be challenged. And then the last thing is that there's a lot of investment coming from the federal government too. And so to the extent there's various infrastructure kind of support that can support both lowered carbon kind of carbon emission kind of infrastructure investments. And that too can also lead to some kind of thing just from the buying power of the United States. So again, it's weaker, but these are also areas that the federal government can respond to. And like I said, states can also have a lot of effect as well. I mentioned New York, I mentioned California. Minnesota actually has a climate action plan in which it tries to do some sort of carbon trade-offs so that it ends up supporting the renewable industry. And so these are all things that various states can do too.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us here in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. From a legal perspective, how are these companies that own the coal mines in the United States going to be challenged or remunerated for not being able to mine their coal? Australia, for instance, sells a great amount of their coal to China. Are they going to somehow be bought out by the United States taxpayers not to mine their coal? Because, of course, any coal burned anywhere in the United in the world is going to create global warming in the rest of the world.
Mike, thanks for the call. If there's no market in the United States, coal companies could sell it to China and elsewhere. Steph, are we just pushing the problem to another part of the planet?
It could be possible that we're just pushing the problem to other elsewhere in the planet. That said, you know, there's a lot of times when companies don't get remunerated for things that they're doing. There's not a guarantee that companies can continue with whatever their plan of operations is. For example, Coca-Cola used to sell Coke with cocaine in it. That became illegal. They did not get remunerated for the sort of lost profits from that. So this, you know, this is part of U.S. history. So it's not that different.
Thanks for that call. Steph, what briefly are you watching for next on the effort to regulate climate change emissions?
I think that there's a lot of interesting things coming from private industry, actually. So we were talking about sort of the coal industry, but a lot of companies, for example, even Walmart, who one does not think of as a particularly lefty kind of company, are actually pushing for investment into renewable infrastructures because they think that that's actually more reliable in terms of power, power generation. And so you see actually sort of a lot of solar plants in Texas. They're actually pushed for by Walmart. And I think that we'll see a lot of companies moving in that direction as they get concerned about, for example, reliability of fossil fuel-based infrastructures, as we're seeing, you know, stuff like unrest in Ukraine affecting some of that. So there, you see sort of almost business versus business kind of dynamic that is happening already. And I think we'll see more of that in the future.
Steph, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. That's Steph Tai, law professor at UW-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences administrative law, with us to talk about last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that limits the EPA's ability to regulate emissions from power plants. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a criminologist about the last time the government banned so-called assault weapons, what effect it had on violence, and calls today to bring that law back. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.